Blog Talk Radio.
This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Monday, April 22nd, day number 112 of 2013. And today we're going to talk about one of the most important topics in the country, and that is immigration reform. We'll have a couple of guests on tonight. On the first segment, Bob Parks. Bob Parks is going to be joining us. And then George Rodriguez from South Texas will be joining us on the second segment. We're going to look at immigration reform. You know, when I planned the show about a week and a half or so, obviously, I didn't know what was going to happen last week in Boston at the Boston Massacre, and I do think this is going to have a great impact on the immigration debate because, as we've seen, there are already some people calling or criticizing the FBI for what they did or didn't do. There are obviously some problems with immigration where people who are here in the country, so I think security is all of a sudden going to become an extremely important issue during the immigration debate. And of course, security on the immigration debate has to do with the border security, which is a huge issue. It was a huge issue before. I think it's just going to be even bigger now. Our book, Cubanos in Wisconsin, is available in print as well as Kindle. We've been doing several presentations here in the Dallas area. I've also been on several radio shows. And if you go to the website, you can read all the print reviews that we have. And listen to some of the audio interviews as well. Not too long ago, I was interviewed by John Batchelor, and was on his nationwide radio show, and we are very grateful for that. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Bob Parks about immigration reform. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, and let's say hello to Bob Parks. How are you, Bob?
Very good, Silvio. How are you doing?
Just fine. How is the weather in the East Coast?
Actually, it's very pleasant. It's sunny, and it's in the upper 50s. It's not bad.
Great. It's about what it is in Dallas. We have a lovely, absolutely lovely day in Dallas, Texas. Well, Bob, we've had you on the show before, but I always like to have our guests tell us a little bit about yourself. So tell us about yourself.
Well, I'm a, let's see, conservative activist, been doing it for the early 2000s. I dabble in video, let's put it that way. I am currently the senior video producer for the Media Research Center, which is probably one of the greatest honors that I've had as far as being able to get the conservative message out, but also go after, I think, one of the biggest problems that we have, and that is media bias. And so basically that's what I do. I do video, and, you know, I blog on my website, black-and-right.com, and I also have a fairly active Facebook page, which you have to be a friend in order to get on.
That's right. I was just going to say, speaking of media bias, have you ever seen it worse than it is right now? I mean, I really haven't.
No, actually, I think a lot of that is because of the rise of the internet and also the fact that I think that they saw an opening, especially with Barack Obama, where they could clearly take a side. At one point, I think it was veiled in the whole desire to be part of history, in working towards seeing the first black president, who just happened to be a Democrat, but
right,
make sure that he got in, and then now make sure he succeeded no matter what. And but no, I don't think any of us can honestly say that we've seen it as bad as it is today, and it's nothing that I see abating anytime soon.
Right, yeah, absolutely. Well, Bob, I think one of the most interesting things about your story is that you lived in Watertown, Massachusetts, which is where, of course, this terrible tragedy of a few days ago. So I guess this tragedy in Boston really hit you hard, I mean, because this is used to be your hometown.
Yes, actually, I mean, what was happening is Thursday night I was watching some TV, and I mean, it was, well, let me retract that. It was, the TV was on, and I really was doing some other things online, and I just noticed that there was some shooting going on near MIT. My father taught at MIT, so that immediately drew me. And then I see there's a gun battle going through the streets of Cambridge, which is another part of the Boston area, which is where I grew up right after I was born. And then it went to Watertown, which is where we moved to when I was nine. And so now all of a sudden, this little town that I grew up in, that is never in the national news. I don't think anybody even knew that Watertown, Massachusetts even existed until early Friday morning. And that's where all the action is. And meanwhile, I'm in upstate Massachusetts myself, and I see what's going on. I got a camera with me. Guess where I'm headed on Friday?
Right.
And I did.
Interesting. Well, would you agree with me, and this is off the topic, I know we're going to talk a little bit about immigration, but I think that what we saw in Watertown, where we saw all these people vulnerable to a madman with a machine gun or grenades, I think a lot of people probably appreciate now the idea of being able to defend themselves, have a gun in their possession or in their home to defend themselves. I mean, I certainly would have felt that way if I was there.
Well, sure. And, you know, one of the things that did frustrate me a bit, and I wrote a piece about that. It's currently on CNSnews.com. I wrote an op-ed this afternoon. And one of the things that did bug me about the media coverage was this sort of sentiment that the people in the Boston area were cowering in fear over this madman with bombs and blah, blah, blah. And you know something? Boston is really, despite the fact that they've got these world-class hospitals and universities, Boston is a blue-collar town. And I think the attitude for the average Bostonian that was inconvenienced with the shutdown of everything in Boston on Friday, the attitude was, they better not come here. And the problem is, they did go there, and that's where the story ended.
That's so, right, in the backyard. And go ahead.
But the point is, I think, Boston is a very liberal town. It's a very democratic town. But it's also a very blue-collar town, and it's conservative to the point, like, well, not really in the Boston area, but everything west of Route 128 in the western half of the state is Democratic, but it's also very conservative. And if there's going to be a problem with in passing any kind of gun legislation, it's going to come out from the western part of the state. But this whole issue now may have galvanized everything east of Route 128, and I think a lot of people will see that there is a need to have some protection in your house if some fool with pressure cookers decides to come into your neighborhood blowing stuff up. I think that there would have been people in that neighborhood, in Watertown or Brockton or Brighton or any neighborhood of Boston, that they would have gone out looking for the guy.
Okay? Absolutely.
It's not like, you know, cower and fear. Bostonians got attitudes, and they would have gone out looking for the guy.
Absolutely. Well, let's go get into the topic of immigration. When I obviously scheduled the show, this was before the Boston Terrorist Act, but I do think it's going to have an impact on the immigration debate, because much of the immigration debate before was about making sure that there was border security, which is obviously a big problem. Well, this is an even bigger problem now. Border security is an even bigger problem now with these two young men in the country, and God only knows who else is in the country. So I think it's a little tougher now to sell immigration reform. Do you agree with me?
Oh, well, here's the whole thing. The left looked at the whole question of who is coming here in a very flippant attitude, because 9/11 was an anomaly. We know that we should be able to trust whoever tries to come into this country, because the majority of the people who come to this country come here to get a better life. I mean, heck, I would love to, if I go out and rob a bank, because that's against the law, and I get a whole lot of money, I could get a better life, too, from that, but it's still against the law. And but the whole point is now you've got real justification to really clamp down and saying, okay, it's not a question of how many people are coming here, but it's also a question of who is coming here. What are their motives? What are their backgrounds? Because, you know, people from Chechnya, I'm sure, are fine people, but you know something? There are always going to be those bad apples, and if they have a tendency to beat their wives and they kind of sound like they're becoming a little radicalized, you know, that might be a red flag for certain people. And especially if the Russian government themselves took the time to warn us about this guy, then I think we should have taken them seriously. And obviously,
right, no,
the FBI,
absolutely.
The FBI, 2020 hindsight, dropped the ball on this one. But, you know, I figure a neighbor will know their other neighbor better than a stranger will. So if the neighbor comes to you and says, stay away from that person, it happens in everyday life, I think the FBI should take that same kind of approach when somebody from the Russian government says you need to look out after this guy. And you can, and we can only imagine what wouldn't have happened had the FBI taken this warning when it was given.
Yeah, this is the young man, of course, the older brother, who even flew to Russia and, as I understand now, flew with an alias. Didn't even have his own name when he was flying. Pretty incredible.
Red flag. And it's so,
yeah, absolutely.
We don't know who's coming across the borders. I mean, especially if we have 11 million, which, you know, as far as I think CIS thinks, has estimated it years ago as being somewhere around 20-something million, we don't know. I mean, if we don't know who's coming in, how can you really sit with a straight face and tell me this is 11 million or 15 million or 4? We don't know what that number is, but we do know that there are economic ramifications if they pass this immigration quote-unquote reform, because government does not do – I think we know that when outside of what they're constitutionally mandated to do, government does not do things well. And usually when they do something on a major scale – such as Obamacare, we usually find out after the fact how much it really costs if we do. And if we do, if we don't know what it's costing, it's only because that price is just going up and up and up at an astronomical pace, and we really don't know what it's going to cost. So we
right.
look at the ramifications as far as housing, education, health care. I mean, the cost to just absorb this many people. And also the word is out now. Obama will take care of us. So the word is out, and the southern border has been opened like a floodgate. One of the things, Silvio, if I may be really brief about this.
Go ahead.
One of the things that has always ticked me off about the immigration debate is when people like Senator Chuck Schumer from New York, and I remember at the time it was Ted Kennedy from Massachusetts, and John Kerry were up there advocating for illegal aliens, but they don't have a proper frame of reference. Now, I lived in Los Angeles for 12 years, and that's when you see, when you live in a border state, you live in a city near a border state, that's when you really see the ramifications economically, socially, of illegal immigration. And people in northern states got no business. I don't care if you're a U.S. senator. You've got no business leading the charge on something that doesn't affect your state to the degree it affects others.
Absolutely.
And so for them to be talking about we should do everything we can to pass immigration reform, first of all, I'd like to ask Chuck Schumer, has he read the bill? Has he read, 1,700 pages?
Right.
I
doubt it. I doubt that he's read the bill, Bob, just like the Obamacare bill. But I wanted to move into another part of this whole debate. A couple of weeks ago, I read a story that there were many blacks leaders concerned about the impact that this would have on blacks in the United States, meaning legalizing 10 to 11 million people at a time, Bob, when the unemployment rate in the black communities is in double digits, 14-15%. And when it gets down to young people, it's even higher than that. What are your thoughts? I mean, what are blacks saying about immigration reform? We don't hear anything about it.
well, it's because it's probably not something that's worth the media's time to echo because it would go against their narrative. The black community, I can only go back to when I was living in Los Angeles, there was a talk show host by the name of Terry Anderson, who was an activist. He was against illegal immigration, not just because of the fight, just the federal and state cost ramifications that would be involved. He was into it because of what he saw socially, what he saw going on the streets. He saw, for example, blacks in South Central Los Angeles. Now, when you say South Central Los Angeles, you automatically assume the black community. Well, the black community went from black to brown just in the time I was there because of the influx of illegal aliens looking for cheaper places to live. A lot of them started to settle in East LA, but it sort of migrated over to South Los Angeles. And there were turf wars. I mean, the gangs would start, we would constantly hear stories. In fact, there was a story about a football player whose mother was in Iraq. And
I remember hearing about that. Yes.
And this high school football player, this black kid was just minding his own business, but a Latino gang member, as part of an initiation, just came and popped him in the back of the head. Okay? This is the kind of thing, now, it goes both ways. I'm not implying that, because this is a turf war. But the social ramifications as far as housing, buildings that are owned by Latinos will only rent to Latinos. That just happens. And so it's created this tension. And, I'm just surprised that there hasn't been a big flash riot somewhere in South Central between blacks and Latinos in the years since I left. But that doesn't mean that it's something that couldn't happen tomorrow. The social ramifications, when you have a group of people who we have made it easy not to assimilate. Let me ask you a question, Silvio.
Yes.
Okay? Now, I grew up in Boston. Because Boston is mostly Irish and Italian, you would think the way things are nowadays that if I got into a public bus or went to a public place, I would see signs in English and Gaelic or English and Italian. But somebody decided they should be in English and Spanish. If you bring your kid from another country and you put him in a public school, if he speaks anything but Spanish, that child is immersed in English and learns English quickly and excels. But for some reason, somebody, and I have done everything I could to try to find out who it was, whose bright idea it was, that decided that Latino people, Spanish-speaking people, were too stupid to learn how to speak English. So we had to create special classes for them. We have to make special signs for them. I'm sorry, that doesn't sound like a very conservative idea to me.
No, in fact, I'll speak about myself. Having come to the United States from Cuba as a kid, we ended up in Wisconsin, and we had two choices. You either speak English or, you better speak English or you better speak English, because that's all there was. Now, I thought it was very helpful for me because it helped me integrate faster into the new country, but I'm opposed to this bilingual education. I don't think it's doing anything at all to help kids integrate into the country. I'm with you on that.
Well, if anything, I think it definitely puts a little bit more money in just union teachers' pocket by creating a whole new class of teachers. But besides that, the statistics, the last that I saw anything on this story as far as bilingual education, has shown that it has been either considered a failure or a worse than failure because the kids are not learning English as far as fast as their counterparts who are immersed.
Right,
but
and as I told many of the parents here in Dallas, the sooner your kids get out of this Spanish-only world, the quicker they're going to, advance, go to college, get a job or whatever. As long as they're speaking Spanish all day, that's not going to help them at all. If you want to do that, you should go back to Mexico. That's where you speak Spanish all day. But if you're going to live here, you might as well focus on on learning English. But let me quickly get back to this topic of blacks and immigration, because the argument that I hear from some Hispanic leaders is, well, look, these guys here, this 10 to 11 million, are already working. So they're not going to take any jobs away from blacks because they're already working. How would you react to that?
Well, I think there's also there's something that we need to come to grips with as a people. First off, if we're going to pay Americans to take the quote-unquote jobs that Americans won't do, it's going to mean paying them more. In some cases, the unions are going to get involved, and that's going to spike the cost of the wages. So certain things like the strawberries and the flowers and just the bus boys and all the other jobs that work at the car wash, the jobs that low-skilled Latinos do, those are going to result in certain costs of certain goods to go up. But at the same time, I do remember when I was living in North Central Massachusetts, where there's not very much of an illegal immigration problem. It was a very white area. In fact, when I and my two sons moved to this certain small town, we increased the black population by 40%. But in that area, the jobs that Americans wouldn't do were done by, get this, young people. Young people in high school who needed after-school jobs. Young people who needed summer jobs. Elderly people who just wanted something to do instead of sit in front of Walmart. There are people. I think the whole argument of there being jobs that people, that Americans won't do, I think a lot of that is a myth, because you don't have to pay people the real high wages, or even the minimum wage in some cases, will do for some kid who's out of high school who just wants some pocket money for Friday and Saturday night. So,
well, that's what I remember, Bob. I mean, that's what I remember growing up in Wisconsin. You know, the kids, high school kids, would get jobs at the gas station. You know, I guess it'd be in the late 60s, early 70s, when they were still pumping gas, or you would get a job at the grocery store, you would get a job just to have pocket money, as you say, to go out Friday night or Saturday night, or put gas in your dad's car so that he wouldn't complain that you're driving the car for free. I mean, these jobs were done. I mean, I worked as a busboy, Bob. I worked at a kitchen when I was in high school washing dishes because I wanted to have some money, and those jobs were available. Now you go into a restaurant, and all of those jobs are being done by people who I assume many of them are in the country illegally.
Yeah, I remember my first job. In fact, it even brought back a memory when I was watching the TV on Thursday night, because one of the car chase happened in front of a Star Market up on Auburn Street in Washington, in Watertown, and that's where I had my very first job. I was a bagger, okay? There was no T in front of it at the time, but, you know, I was. That's what I did. And we did those jobs, and we look at today where you've got a lot of young people who are sitting around watching video games. They don't have anything to do, and we wonder why they don't have a work ethic. Well, maybe it's because they don't have a job, and it doesn't have to be a high-paying job. They don't want a high-paying job. They're not qualified for a job that requires them to do a lot of serious thinking. They just need a job so they can get some money so they can go out and have fun on Friday and Saturday night and go to the movies and take a girl or whatever.
Well, and develop a work ethic. That's the other thing, too, that I think is very important. You know, when I was, I remember that when I was 17, I wanted to get a stereo, you know, because I wanted to buy a new stereo. And I went to my dad, and my dad said, well, have you thought about getting a job? And I said, well, okay, I hadn't thought about that, but thanks for you know, telling me that. So I walked over to the pizza shop in our neighborhood, and the guy there, you know, I said to the guy, look, I like to ask for a job. And he said, well, can you come in after school on Friday nights and wash the dishes? And I said, yeah, I'd love to do that. So Friday nights, Saturday nights, I would wash dishes. I would make, I don't know, whatever it was that I made. But it was money that then I turned around and I bought the stereo, so it taught me something about work ethic. And I had pocket money, as you say, so I could take a girl out or whatever. This is very important, and I think young people today are missing out on that.
Well, there are lots of ramifications for illegal immigration, and I think the biggest problem that we have is the do something mentality of our legislators in Washington, because they clearly make problems worse. I think the best illustration of it, and the most recent one that everybody I think can relate to, is Obamacare. They wanted to pass it before they saw what was in it. I mean, the illegal immigration problem is bad enough. We don't need any more problems, and find out later what the new problem is going to be that they have now created. In order to implement this immigration reform, they're going to have to create new bureaucracies on top of the ones that are inefficient as it stands now. So we're going to be spending so much more money. They said something like maybe this immigration bill is going to cost something like $2 to $3 trillion. $2 to $3 trillion. And I think this is just the first year. I mean, we're having problems right now reining in Barack Obama at just $1 trillion a year over. We're talking $2 to $3 trillion. And that's just not with just the set amount of illegals that are here. Right. There's going to be more because they promise they're going to shut. They're going to fix the border. They're going to finish the fence. They promise. They promise. Didn't they promise that they were going to have this wall done before? And they still have had people fighting it. They've had funding issues. They just recently, because of the quote unquote sequester, they pulled Border Patrol agents from the border. So more
right.
people are flooding in at a very convenient time. Come on. We know what this is all about.
Right.
This is all about the Democratic Party just trying to bring in 11 to 20 million new constituents to assure them victories from here on for as far as the eye can see. That's all.
That's right.
About.
Well, let me ask you one last question. If you look at most of the you know, what I would say the black districts, you know, like the one that we have here in Texas or in Dallas, represented by Adie Bernice Johnson, why is it that you don't hear more from black representatives or, you know, black city council people? Why is it that they don't publicly come out and talk more about the unemployment and the impact that legalizing people would have, unemployment? It seems like the black leaders are very quiet about this. Is it loyalty to President Obama? Is that all?
Yeah, I'm going to be very harsh here.
Okay.
And I never lied to you, Sylvia, so I'm going to tell you like it is. I don't believe that these politicians care. They have got their power. They've got their perks of power. How would you like to work for Sheila Jackson Lee? Okay? These people do not care. They are doing what their party masters have told them to do. And all this is going to do is just ensure Democratic victories. So as long as they've got their position of power and their perks and their money, I mean, tell me, what do you see Sheila Jackson Lee or Bernice, or what's the congressman?
Adie Bernice
name
Johnson.
That's
Adie
right.
Bernice Johnson.
What do you see her doing if she's not a congresswoman?
Well,
what
I mean, what I see her doing a couple of years ago was there was a big controversy about scholarships in her district where they were taking scholarships from some of the black kids in their district and giving it to her friends. I mean, that's what I saw. I mean, this lady's as corrupt as they come.
No, but the thing is, she doesn't care.
Right.
She knows that she can hide under the cloak of, if you accuse her of anything, it's racism and
right.
all that. And that's what it always comes down to. So these people don't care. And you know something? You look at the state of the black community, and you look at it over the course of our lifetime where everything has just gotten worse. Can you tell me there's a politician there who really cares?
Well, I don't see any. I'll be honest with you. It's a very sad thing to say, but I don't see any. I see. I hate to say it, but I think most blacks in this country are governed by some very bad people in the districts that they are living in. And example number one, exhibit number one, is right here in Dallas. Adie Bernice Johnson, a very corrupt lady, but nevertheless, she is reelected with 70 or 75%. Every single time. Well, Bob, that's going to do it. Thank you so much for joining us. Your input is always absolutely great. One more time, tell us about your your current position and what you're doing.
Okay, well, I am the senior video producer for the Media Research Center. That's Brent Bozell's group with the Newsbusters blog, the CNS News. It's a great media bias weapon to keep the people educated as to what the media is trying to do and very much succeeding. And also my website is blackandright.com, which is black-and-right.com.
Well, I want to thank you very much. I want to thank you very much for joining us today, and it's always a great pleasure to chat with you, and I hope we can do it again.
Come at any time, Sylvia.
Okay, you have a great day, Bob.
Thanks, you too. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation about immigration reform. We'll bring in my good friend George Rodriguez from South Texas. Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. Great conversation there with Bob Parks. Bob with the Bren Bozell group. You know, of course, some of you who watch The Hannity Show, you know that from time to time he's on that program. Just a quick on this day in history before we get to Bob. 1889, the Oklahoma land rush began. That's when people began flooding the state. What was then a territory eventually became a state. And of course, in 1994, on this day, President Nixon passed away. He had suffered a stroke for several days before, and he finally passed away on this day in 1994. Let's say hello to George Rodriguez. How are you, George?
Real good. How are you doing, Silvio?
Absolutely great. I think you had a chance to hear a little bit of what Bob Parks was saying about... I think you had a chance to hear probably about 10 minutes or so of what he was saying. But of course, just to wrap up the point that he was making there is that, you know, the impact of immigration is going to be of legalizing 10 to 11 million people. I can understand legalizing some of them in certain circumstances, but it's going to have a tremendous impact on the black community because of the very high unemployment rate.
Of course it is. And, you know, and this is what's amazing to me is how well these particularly Hispanic liberals will speak out of both sides of their face. On one moment, they will be talking about how terrible the unemployment and how we need to do more to employ Hispanics and how we need more public works programs. But then on the other one, they turn around and they want to bring in millions more to compete for those jobs. I mean, it just is amazing to me how they can get away with it.
Now, the argument they would make, and I was bringing this up when Bob was with us as well, the argument they would make is, well, look, these guys are already here. They're already in the country. They're not really taking jobs away from anybody. So why not legalize them so that they can at least pay taxes and we know who they are? That's the argument that they come up with. Now, some would say, well, sure, they're working, but they're the mere fact that they are working is because they're willing to work for less than some legal Americans. That would be the other side of the argument.
I have got to agree with that because the issue of immigration in the United States is one that's complex, and it's tied to the social situation that we've got with youth. I mean, you've got to ask yourself, just like you were talking with Bob a little while ago, you know, when was the last time that a teenager came to your house to offer to cut your grass? You know, that used to be the norm when we were growing up. And,
right. Yeah,
you know,
that
is far from it. On the contrary, what you find now are mostly, well, it's almost here in San Antonio, it's always a non-documented person that will come knocking on your door and offer to cut your grass or to cut the trees, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the number one thing, but that's one thing right there is that we've got a society that has become lazier, particularly among the youth. The second thing that we've got is that we've got an economy, we've got a business sector that really, really does depend to a very, very large degree on undocumented workers. And they depend on it because, you know, they will, I mean, I know for a fact that they will exploit them. They, when I worked at immigration back in the Reagan administration, we regularly found situations where flower pickers were being paid a lot less, if not, right after the season was over, most of them were dismissed, in some cases without having been paid fully or for the last week. You've got a lot of horror stories when it comes to the issue of the economics and the business in the business community with undocumented aliens.
Absolutely. In fact, I think we've shared this before with you when you were on, but I've seen situations where people have come to me. I was teaching some English classes, and some people in the class were obviously in the country illegally, and they came to me and they said, how do I fix this problem? You know, somebody doesn't want to pay me, and I worked for him. And I said, well, that's tough luck because, you know, what are you going to do, file a lawsuit when you don't have papers? So it is really painful to see how they are exploited. But, Bob, I wanted to ask you a question about – I'm sorry, George. I said Bob, forgive me. George, I want to ask you about what just happened in Boston and the terrible tragedy of those people being killed in the Boston massacre and how that's going to impact immigration. Because I think even if you are willing to accept – some kind of immigration reform, maybe the legalization of some people who are here who are willing to pay a fine and do a background check and so on. Even if you're willing to accept that, and I was willing to accept that to a point, I don't believe in a path to citizenship, but some kind of legalization I can see for some people. Now, this is going to be a lot more difficult because what was holding it up before, or the big contention before, Boston Terrorist Act was this, the border security. Well, what happened in Boston last week is not helping border security one bit, George.
That's exactly right. I think that it's obvious from the conversations that I'm hearing that people are now saying no, that the border must be secured even more so. Most people were talking about the issue of border security as being the primary issue to start the discussion. Well, now it is really even more so the focus. You've got Schumer making the comment yesterday on one of the talk shows saying that he was not, you know, in a very, very gallant manner, he was not going to let the right-wingers, as he put it, hijack the conversation based on the Boston attack. Well, I got news for him. It's already been hijacked. It was hijacked on Monday. It was hijacked on Tuesday, and as they found out more and more about these two individuals that committed the act, it has been more. It's gotten worse. We have a bad situation now. Here we've got a situation where you've got two individuals that entered legally. You know, they came in through the proper process. However, there really wasn't any kind of background check, so to speak. There were some red flags apparently that were up, but these individuals flew under the radar for whatever reason. On the other hand, I know for a fact that down in South Texas, even during the because of the sequester, we had some what they call OTMs, other than Mexicans, that were picked up. There were about 20 Muslims that were picked up that had crossed the border illegally from Nuevo Laredo, and then they were released. They were given some kind of a permit or something that they needed to, or a note that they needed to come back and report within a month. You know, heaven only knows if they ever did come back, but they were released. And again, they blamed the sequester that they couldn't keep it. How many of those situations, those are the ones that we know about, how many other situations do we not know about where people have entered illegally that we have no knowledge of who they are and what they're here for and where they've gone?
Right. And there's another thing too, Bob, and this is this would come under the heading of security, although not specifically the U.S.-Mexico border security, What about people who come into the country on a tourist visa and choose to stay? I don't think we have a very good way of keeping track of these people. Many of the illegals in the United States are not people that came through Mexico. They are people
right.
who come in. They come in on vacation, and they choose to stay. I think that's a problem. I've heard that's a problem, for example, from some people from South America who come here on a tourist visa. They stay, and then they get a job in the community itself where they live, and they operate here for years. Now, they're not bad people, but they, you know, it doesn't take as we've seen. Doesn't take a lot of them. I mean, it just takes a couple of them.
Exactly. You know, the situation that we've got is that we've got a broken system. You know, in my church, we've got a gentleman who has who brought an orphan Korean 23 years ago, and the child's paperwork has been lost twice. I mean,
right.
You know, that's when it's done legally. Can you imagine when it's not? I mean,
right.
The system is broken, and it's not a question of just building a fence. It is a question of doing some due diligence on people that have entered the United States so that we know where they are and who they are and why they are here.
Absolutely. No, you're exactly right. But one thing I wanted to say to Senator Schumer, he was talking about right-wingers. He must mean those right-wingers like the Democrat senator from Arkansas and the Democrat senator from Louisiana and the Democrat senator from the Dakotas, all of them who voted against the gun control bill.
Right.
You know, because I actually think this is going to make it very difficult for those so-called red state Democrats. I mean, all these visa problems and so on. It's going to make it very difficult for many of them to support the immigration bill. So you could very well have a situation very similar to what happened with the gun control bill, where it was Democrats who brought it down because they just couldn't, they just couldn't sell this to their constituents. But to me, Bob, the real challenge here and is for people like you and me who do want to fix this thing. And I'm, as I said before, I'm willing to offer a certain pathway to legalization to some people so they can work here on a guest worker visa or something like that. I mean, I'm willing to go that far, Bob. I mean, George. But now, all of a sudden, I'm saying, wait a minute, put everything on hold until you can show me that the system works.
Exactly. That's exactly right. I mean, we have always been a nation of immigrants for work, that come here to work. That's no one can deny that, and that is the primary thing that made America great, is that so many people come here and live the American dream. However, it's a different world that we're looking at now. It is a different world where we've got people who are coming here strictly with the idea of waiting for the right opportunity to be damaged. And somehow we've got to be able to weed them out. You know, somehow we've got to be able to at least identify some of them. And if you do identify them, hopefully you'll do something, you know, without having to read the Miranda rights to them.
Right. Well, and of course, you know, getting back to the terrorist thing, I mean, the problem with terrorism, and it doesn't really do you any good to prosecute the guy after he's committed the terrorist
exactly.
act. You want to get him before, and because that's the only way you can prevent these tragic losses of life. I just see a lot of problems, and I don't say this. I mean, I'm sad to say this because I was willing to support something, but I don't see this thing moving very far because I just see the problems that we have, the bureaucratic problems that we have, the lack of control that we have inside the country. I think there's going to be a reaction, George, on the part of people saying, hey, don't talk to me about immigration reform until you show me that the country is safe. I think that's the next phase where this is
headed. That's exactly what I'm hearing already. That is exactly what I am hearing already. And you know, I cannot blame people because if you don't know who has entered, if there's not a proper screening situation, a screening process whereby you know who has entered, you know why they entered, you know where they are after they entered. If you don't have some type of proper screening and follow-up, well, you know, anything can happen and anything is happening. And I do believe, Silvio, that we're going to have, it won't be long before we have another situation. We are going to have another situation because I am very, very concerned and convinced that this was not an isolated situation. There are other people out there waiting to take a shot at us. And if that happens again, that's when really the immigration reform conversation is going to be really completely altered.
Absolutely. Let me ask you one more question, somewhat related to the Boston Terrorist Act. You know, I think we saw in Boston when you had this guy running around, you know, hiding in homes and threatening homes. And to me, that was almost like Exhibit A for the Second Amendment. I think it's going to be very difficult to tell people that they shouldn't have a gun in their home. I mean, what if this guy had broken into your home? Now, we got lucky, I think, because the guy was wounded, and he probably didn't have a lot of strength from what we can tell. I mean, he was bleeding to death. In fact, if we had not discovered him in that boat, he probably would have bled to death, because I don't think he had the energy anymore to run any further. But, you know, do you agree with me that gun control is also one of the issues that really took a hit with this tragedy in Boston?
Yeah, I have heard comments over and over again about, you know, what if people would have only had, you know, this guy should have had a permit. Well, I couldn't, you know, why didn't he have a permit? Well, because he's an outlaw.
Right, exactly, yeah. That's a good point. We just learned today that both of these guys, the older brother and the younger brother, had guns they weren't supposed to have.
Exactly.
I mean, they both had guns and ammunition and grenades, and all of it was illegal. And I'm sitting there saying, no kidding. You mean outlaws have guns. Now, isn't that a concept, George?
Isn't that, you know, not only that, but what if you would have, you know, if we would have had that ridiculous law that says you can only have 10 bullets. I mean, how many bullets did they have? They fired, from my understanding, in one burst, they fired over 80. So, you know, obviously they were not playing by the rules.
No, well, they never do, of course. That's why they're outlaws. They never do. But you know, what's really amazing to me, one last thing, George, what's really amazing to me is how lucky we got, really, in this incident. And I hate to say luck when three people were killed, but think about this. I mean, this young man was bleeding to death, and that's probably why he wasn't able to kill more people. I really do believe he would have taken somebody, some family hostage if he had had the strength to run around a little bit further. And then when they were in the car and they were throwing those grenades and those bombs out, there could have been a lot more policemen killed.
Can you imagine? I mean, it was really a surreal situation. And again, that is why it's very difficult for me to understand how liberals can continue to argue against the idea of the Second Amendment while this was going on. I mean, how can you really, really say that, you know, the good law-abiding citizen is always going to be safe while the outlaws have all the guns?
Right. No, exactly. And we say this in full support of the police. I mean, they do a great job, but they can't be everywhere, as we saw in Boston. You know, they cannot be everywhere. But, George, I forgot to have you tell us about yourself. Forgive me for doing that. So give me a quick bio before we go.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I'm president of the South Texas Alliance for Progress, an educational and informational nonprofit here in South Texas. And we are busy trying to do grassroots organizing to combat Battleground Texas here in what we see as the heart of their beachhead, because we've got a Julian Castro right here in our backyard.
Yes, you have the Castro brothers in your neighborhood, don't you?
Oh, gosh, yes. And
they're twins, aren't they? They're twins,
yep,
right? Is that right?
In fact, it's Fiesta Week. Tonight is the River Parade, and I will tell you, 6 years ago, when one of them was the city councilman, he could not be on the float on the River Parade. So he switched with his twin, and his twin tended to be him. And it wasn't until 2 days later that people found out that were very, very upset that these guys had fooled them. I mean, all they had to do was say, well, my twin couldn't be here, so I'm in here in his place. But for them to pretend that one was the other, you know, without saying anything, you know, really, you know, he got people a little upset.
It's amazing to me the people that Democrats will vote for. Not only people like that, but look at that lady in Massachusetts who was saying that she was 132nd Cherokee or something like that. It's just amazing to me what Democrats will vote
Every
for. But
I have got to laugh. My gosh, 32nd
yes.
Cherokee.
Yes, 132nd Cherokee. I mean, how do you even say something like that with a straight face? 132nd Cherokee. I mean, that's as ridiculous. Well, George, as always, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for so much for joining us on short notice. Keep up the great work, and we will have you back again, I hope.
You take care, and you keep up the good work yourself. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, George. George Rodriguez from San Antonio, Texas. Always a lot of fun to touch base with George. We're going to take a little break, and we'll come back with a closing commentary right after this. Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. And again, our thanks to Bob Parks and George Rodriguez for joining us for this very, very interesting chat about immigration reform. As I mentioned, I'm willing to support some type of immigration plan that includes, for certain people, a path to legalization. I have never supported a path to citizenship. I think that's ridiculous. To give somebody an opportunity to be a citizen of the United States when they came into the country illegally. But some type of a guest worker visa, some type of that kind of a plan, I certainly don't have a problem with that, as long as there are, you know, background checks and certain penalties that the people pay to recognize that they broke the law. But I think, unfortunately, this terrible tragedy in Boston, I think, has put the total dysfunctional nature of our immigration system right on the front page. And I think not only do we have now border security to worry about, we've got people in the country that we have to worry about. And frankly, as I mentioned to George Rodriguez, there's lots and lots of illegal immigrants in the country who come in and overstay their visas. And many of these people are in the community and working and so on. They're not bad people in the sense that they're out there committing crimes or whatever. But I think that we as a country have got to have better control of who's in the country, and we are going to have to start going after people, particularly those who overstay their visas. We're going to have to figure out some way of going after people like that. Just a quick heads up, tomorrow's show, we're going to be doing a program on U.S. Latin America. We're going to be focusing on what's happening in Peru. If you've been following the situation in Latin America, Peru is a real success story. They're doing quite well. They've implemented some free market solutions, some free market ideas, and they're doing quite well. We're also going to be getting an update on what's happening in Venezuela. Of course, the situation there is not doing very well, and we're going to be chatting with a special guest, John Perdue, who wrote a book about Latin America and some of the connections between drug dealers and some of the terrorist groups. So we'll be talking with him, and of course, Fausto Wirtz is going to be joining us as well. One more time, our book, Cubanos in Wisconsin, the book is available in print. The book is available in Kindle. I have a link to the book there on the show information. You can click on that and go to the website. And you know what? If you go to the website and you want a signed copy, we'll do that for you. Follow the procedures there on the website, and I'll sign you a copy. And if you want a copy for your Cuban grandmother or your Cuban grandparents, your Cuban parents, and listen, it's a great honor when I get to sign a book like that for your Cuban parents or Cuban grandparents. Everybody have a wonderful day, and we'll talk to you later. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.